earlier in the show, we heard from Jennifer Brea, who caught a virus on a trip to Kenya and came down with a really high fever.
At its highest was 104.7 degrees.
But Jen never got better. She started getting strange symptoms. She would feel dizzy and numb, and she'd have moments when she couldn't even speak or write. She went from doing 20-mile bike rides to collapsing after just a short walk.
And it just kind of got worse and worse and worse.
Jen went to all kinds of specialists who didn't know what was wrong with her, and then one of them came up with a diagnosis, conversion disorder.
He told me everything that you've been experiencing is psychosomatic, that the symptoms are real, but that they have no biological cause.
That diagnosis, the idea that her symptoms were all in her head, left Jen feeling even more helpless. And then on top of that, she would later find out that her diagnosis, conversion disorder, used to be called hysteria. Jennifer Brea picks up the story from the TED stage.
When my doctor diagnosed me with conversion disorder, he was invoking a lineage of ideas about women's bodies that are over 2,500 years old. The Roman physician Galen thought that hysteria was caused by sexual deprivation in particularly passionate women. The Greeks thought that the uterus would literally dry up and wander around the body in search of moisture, pressing on internal organs. Yes. Causing symptoms from extreme emotions to dizziness and paralysis. These ideas went largely unchanged for several millennia until the 1880s, when neurologists tried to modernize the theory of hysteria. Sigmund Freud developed a theory that the unconscious mind could produce physical symptoms when dealing with memories or emotions too painful for the conscious mind to handle. It converted these emotions into physical symptoms. This meant that men could now get hysteria, but of course, women were still the most susceptible. Why has this idea had such staying power? I do think it has to do with sexism, but I also think that fundamentally, doctors want to help. They want to know the answer. And this category allows doctors to treat what would otherwise be untreatable, to explain illnesses that have no explanation. The problem is that this can cause real harm. In the 1950s, a psychiatrist named Elliot Slater studied a cohort of 85 patients who had been diagnosed with hysteria. 9 years later, 12 of them were dead, and 30 had become disabled. Many had undiagnosed conditions like multiple sclerosis, epilepsy, brain tumors. In 1980, hysteria was officially renamed conversion disorder. When my neurologist gave me that diagnosis in 2012, he was echoing Freud's words verbatim. The problem with the theory of hysteria or psychogenic illness is that it can never be proven. It is, by definition, the absence of evidence.
Jen, of course, didn't believe she had conversion disorder, but she had trouble convincing doctors that her symptoms were serious.
I had this problem of when I was well enough to go to a doctor, I would look pretty normal, and then when I was experiencing my symptoms, I would never be able to go in.
So she decided to start filming herself at home with her iPhone.
I don't think I can get up off the couch. Ugh.
And when I was able to bring in these videos...
The right side of my face feels numb. I feel like my brain is misfiring.
It just had changed the conversation when they could really see what it was like.
Yeah.
I figure it's good to just keep documenting. Okay, turn off the light.
But even then, her doctors couldn't make sense of her symptoms.
So, like, in the doctor's office, there was all these strange symptoms that had no pattern that they couldn't understand or describe or categorize or name.
So Jen did something that a lot of doctors don't particularly like.
I think one of the most annoying things for doctors that a patient can do is go on the internet and Google their symptoms. And even though... oftentimes I was Googling PubMed and Nature and Science and bringing them into my doctors. There was this sense that, you know, the internet is really unreliable, which it is. It's like a wild west and you'll find all kinds of information.
But along with those studies, Jen found something else online.
There are literally thousands of people that all have the same pattern of symptoms.
The same symptoms Jen's doctors couldn't make sense of.
This community of people who all had... ME, myalgic encephalomyelitis.
Myalgic encephalomyelitis, a disease that seemed to fit with the symptoms Jen was experiencing. So through that online community, Jen connected with ME experts across the country.
I found a doctor in Boston at Mass General, a doctor in Miami, in New York, a doctor in Nevada, and a doctor in California. So I've actually been diagnosed 5 times with ME.
Hmm. Why is it so difficult to diagnose?
It's difficult to diagnose because it's not really a part of the medical school curricula. So at most medical schools, you're not required to learn about the symptoms and the pathophysiology of the disease. So one doctor that I saw in Miami, when she was a professor of immunology, she had to sort of teach medical students during their lunch hour because it wasn't a part of the curriculum.
Myalgic encephalomyelitis. You've probably heard it called chronic fatigue syndrome. The key symptom we all share is that whenever we exert ourselves, physically, mentally, we pay, and we pay hard. If my husband goes for a run, he might be sore for a couple of days. If I try to walk half a block, I might be bedridden for a week. It is a perfect custom prison. I know ballet dancers who can't dance, accountants who can't add, medical students who never became doctors. It doesn't matter what you once were. You can't do it anymore. It's estimated that about 15 to 30 million people around the world have this disease. In the US, where I'm from, it's about 1 million people. That makes it roughly twice as common as multiple sclerosis. Patients can live for decades with the physical function of someone with congestive heart failure. 25% of us are homebound or bedridden, and 75 to 85% of us can't even work part-time. How could a disease this common and this devastating have been forgotten by medicine? All around the world, ME is one of the least funded diseases. So in the US, we spend each year roughly $2,500 per AIDS patient, $250 per MS patient, and just $5 per year per ME patient.
It feels like ME patients face this kind of dilemma because it's sort of mysterious. No one is funding research into it. But then the only way to figure out what the mystery is to fund it, right?
Yeah, it's this sort of really weird situation where people say, well, we don't know anything about it yet. And whenever anyone says that to me, I kind of feel like I'm standing next to this like giant rock. And everyone's like, well, we don't know what's underneath that rock. Like, what could possibly be under? And I'm like, lift it up. Just like lift it up and look, you know? You can't answer the questions that you don't ask. You can't understand what you don't study. You can't find what you're not looking for.
Yeah. And I wonder if like on a more personal level, you were going through this process constantly where you were asking yourself, like, you know, what's wrong with me? What's happening to me? And then finding this community of people online probably made you feel like you weren't the only one asking those questions.
You know, it's a funny thing because being able to connect to people who are sharing your experience is profound. I thought I had a rare disease. For those first 2 years, I thought maybe I'm dying. No one could tell me what my prognosis was. No one could tell me what this was going to be like. Even if in that moment, what I was grappling with felt so big and so terrifying that I wouldn't survive it, the fact that other people had gone through that and had survived gave me hope that I would be able to find a way.
What else gives you hope?
I think what is hard to sort of see from the outside is that humans are really adaptable. And I've kind of grown into this. And so on the one hand, every day I try to live the life that I have as well as I possibly can. I'm also fighting for a better life at the same time. And I know that there are so many drugs I have never tried. I know that there are so many experiments that have never been run. And so I believe that if we just started
trying to answer these basic questions, that we could find treatments and explanations for this disease within a matter of years. So I think that I could get a lot better, and I think that I could get a lot better while I'm still young. And that's really what I'm fighting for every day.
That's Jennifer Brea. You can see her entire talk at TED.com. And by the way, those iPhone videos she took of herself at home, those actually inspired her to make a documentary about chronic fatigue syndrome. It's done mostly from her bedside at home. It's called Unrest, and it premiered earlier this year at Sundance. Thanks for listening to our show, Getting Better, this week. If you want to find out more about who was on it, go to ted.npr.org. To see hundreds more TED Talks, check out ted.com or the TED app. Our production staff at NPR includes Jeff Rogers, Brent Bachman, Megan Kane, Neva Grant, Sanaz Meshkinpour, Casey Herman, Rachel Faulkner, and Rund Abdel Fattah, with help from Camilo Garcon and Daniel Shukin. Our intern is Thomas Liu. Our partners at TED are Chris Anderson, Kelly Stetzel, Anna Phelan, and Janet Lee. If you want to let us know what you think about the show, you can write us at tedradiohour@npr.org. And you can follow us on Twitter. It's at tedradiohour. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to Ideas Worth Spreading right here on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.